Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we're going to go ahead and get started with the agenda since it's 10:15, and we'll let everyone know once we have a quorum. Today on the agenda, we have several different groups that are going to be coming up and enlightening us on who they are and what they do, and we look forward to hearing from those groups and working with them throughout the session. The first group up that we'll have today is the Association of Minnesota Counties. Then we'll have the Association of Townships. And then we're looking forward to hearing from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association as well. So first up, looks like Mr. Hilgart and Ms. Ring from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Julie Ring. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And Matt Hilgart and I today are going to give you a very brief presentation focused a little bit on the nature of counties in Minnesota and a little bit on what we do for counties and what we can do for you. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hilgart.
Mr. Chair and members, I would echo what Julie Ring just said. Thank you for the invitation today to be here. We are going to be providing just a brief overview about the Association of Minnesota Counties, the role that counties play in Minnesota communities, a brief demographic kind of survey of counties, and a little bit about the structure of our board and the operations of our group. As members may know, AMC is a membership-based organization that represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. Our main mission is to assist in the provision of effective county government on behalf of all Minnesotans. And we do this by providing many things. We do this by providing education, training, communication materials to our members, and also by advocating on behalf of these counties at state and federal government levels. And Julie will go into more specifics later on, too. A brief overview of counties by the numbers. As I mentioned, there are 87 counties, ranging from our largest county, which is St. Louis County, over 7,000 square miles. It's the second largest county in the nation, to our smallest county, which is Ramsey County, albeit not the smallest county in population. We have 447 elected county commissioners. Minnesota statutes actually allow for there to be a 3, 5, 7, or 9 member county board, but all counties either choose to be a 5 member or a 7 member county board. There are currently 7 counties, or sorry, 6 counties that have the 7 board members, and those are Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, and St. Louis. Total county expenditures per year range anywhere from $6 million to $1.5 billion, with Red Lake County being on that smaller edge of $5.96 million, and Hennepin County being around $1.46 billion. So pretty diverse group of counties. Regarding population, here's just a simple graph kind of showing our county demographics. Close to 75% of our counties, or more, almost 75% of our counties are under that 40,000 population threshold. Because Minnesota is organized under the Dillon Rule, local governments and counties are only able to possess powers that are conferred to us by the state legislature. And just a very brief kind of collection of some of the general duties of a county board. Approve budget and expenditures, approve taxes, administer elections, which I'm sure this committee will be discussing in more detail as the session goes on. Manage corrections, manage roads, ditches, develop land use and water policies, protecting public health, providing social services and welfare, managing solid waste. The bulk of these services are delivered by a collaboration of county departments. And while some of these services are funded by the state legislature, most often counties rely on the property tax system and levying authority given to us by the state legislature. And with that, I would turn it over to our executive director, Julie Ring.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Ring. We wanted to give you a couple snapshots on counties. So we've given you a document that is titled Why Minnesota Counties Matter. It's a color document in your handouts that I think highlights some of the bullet points that Matt just shared with you, gives you some, just a snapshot of some statistics of the work that counties do. We, as administrative arms of the state do administer most of the programs that you establish in one way or another. And so our staff, which I'll share a list with you later, our staff attends nearly every committee hearing that exists at the legislature. The only place that we don't have to spend a lot of time is in education, because we don't, as counties, have responsibilities for schools. We also gave you an ever-popular handout, which is the What's in a Name handout. In case you were wondering the origin of your county's name or your neighbor in county's names, there's some kind of fun facts in there. We always joke that we should do a bingo game or a trivia game related to this for our members, because I think there's some fun stories behind your county's names.
So, Ms. Ring, I'm going to interrupt you there really quick just to let, for the record, we do now have a quorum.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members. So Matt alluded to the fact that AMC is a voluntary association of all 87 of Minnesota's counties. We are the only statewide county association that represents all counties in Minnesota. You will interact with other associations that represent subsets of our members that have similarities, and we work really closely with those associations, but they are not affiliated with AMC. They are separate independent organizations. We believe we are the voice of county government in Minnesota. We strive to tell the story of counties in a variety of settings and to provide our members with the tools to do that at home. We also are an education, training, and communication resource for counties, both commissioners, other elected officials, and staff. In fact, I ran over here today. We are in the midst of our new what we used to call our new county commissioner school, we now call our newly elected county official school, because the other county officials also attend that. So county commissioners and newly elected auditors, treasurers, recorders from across the state are meeting just down the road today. And when I left, they were learning all the ins and outs of open meeting law. We are governed by a board of directors. AMC is a 501c3 and C4 arm. That is our advocacy arm. We are a nonprofit organization governed by a board of directors of 32 members from across the state. Our board is made up entirely of county commissioners. Our executive committee is 5 county commissioners from across the state. Our current president is Freeborn County Commissioner Chris Schaff, in the middle of that photo. He and our second vice president are in a race for who's the tallest at the moment. But our first vice president, Jack Swanson, is also in the photo, and our second vice president, Gary Hendricks. They are from Roseau and Swift counties. Our past president is Ramsey County Commissioner Tony Carter, and our secretary-treasurer is a former member of the legislature, Hennepin County Commissioner Linda Higgins. We have 3 legislative principles that underpin all of the advocacy work we do and much of what we will talk to you about. And I'm not going to read these to you, but as you, I think, would expect, they are focused on local control. They're focused on adequacy of resources. And that's because, as Matt shared with you, we are, in a sense, creatures of this legislature. You do create all of our work. Because of the way counties are organized in Minnesota, we can only do what you tell us to do. And so if there are things that we're doing that you're not a fan of, that's a great place for us to start a conversation. We don't have the general authority that other local levels of government have to do things but what is prohibited by the legislature. We are the opposite. We're only allowed to do what you authorize. And so that's why you see a lot of county issues, and you'll see a lot of us in the coming year. I'm not going to go through all the steps, but what I want you to take away from the next 2 to 3 slides is we have a very involved legislative platform development process that engages all of our members from across the state. Both the elected officials and the department heads guide our work. Any county official can suggest a legislative platform item to our process independently. It doesn't have to be by board resolution. Everybody's ideas come to the table. We have policy committees that sit down and discuss those in depth. And then we have a process that involves district meetings, conversations around the state, and a vote at our annual meeting. Our platform is a 26-page long document that is posted on our website, and we are happy to talk about, but we also realize that 26 pages is a little bit unwieldy. And so in recent years, we've started developing a list of legislative priorities. These are voted on in numerous settings to get us down to a small list of priorities. And what I can tell you about the priorities we have this year and any year is that those are things that are either adopted by unanimous vote or by upwards of 80% is our threshold. We aren't interested in bringing highly divisive issues to you. We don't think that that's in the best interest of our members. There is enough that we have in common as counties that we want to come and talk to you about things where there is a great deal of agreement. And so for an item to make it onto our priority list, it requires a great deal of support statewide, which you'll see if you're reading ahead already, or you'll see in the next couple slides. So we do have a short list of priorities. I'm not going to run through all of these. They are not all or even mostly in the jurisdiction of this particular committee, but I know you sit on many committees, and so you'll have the opportunity to talk to our staff about our priorities for the year. It is a broad list meant specifically to show you the scope of the work we do, everything from transportation to corrections to public health, human services, and more. And then this last slide I actually gave you a full-page handout of because I think it's a really important slide, even if you don't read all the little type. And what it is intended to demonstrate to you is that there is a lot of agreement between counties on our priority issues. When we go out and we ask districts to filter through a list of about 25 items, we have a lot of discussion, and then we ask them to vote on what are the most important items to that district. What is highlighted on your handout and on the slide in red are the things that were common across most or all districts. And the point of the slide is for you to see that there are far more similarities than differences. And some of the differences are based on geographic concerns, and they make it onto our list of priorities even though they aren't statewide, because they're so important to a particular corner of the state. And so I'm happy at any time, as are any of our staff, to talk to you about any of these priorities, but the point was to demonstrate to you that there is a lot of agreement across counties, statewide, and across all of your districts. I also provided you with a handout so that you can get a sense of who our staff are. We do have a team of policy analysts that work at the Capitol in specific areas, and it's often easier if you can identify them visually, so we've given you that so that if you have questions about a particular topic area, you know where to go and who to contact. We work on behalf of our members to pull together common ideas across counties. And for you, we want you to know that AMC is a nonpartisan, statewide organization, and our job is to provide you with the information you need to make good decisions. And we are committed to telling you both or every side of the story, if there's more than two. We will certainly tell you what we would like you to do, what our association has voted on as a priority, but we are very happy to tell you if there's any dissent, if your county has a different perspective, if there are specific people that you should talk to on any issue. We're very committed to not only forwarding our agenda, but to being an important resource to you so that you can make good choices about the public policy you're working on. And I think that's my last slide. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members, Matt and I would be happy to answer any questions either now or at any point in the future.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Ring. Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Very good presentation. Excellent job on the infographic. Very nice.
Thank you. I will take that compliment back to the staff who created it.
Very helpful. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Ring, question for you. Regarding District 10's legislative priorities, do you have a document that has greater detail on the specifics that are for that 7-county metro area?
Yes, I'd be very happy to share that with you.
I'd appreciate that. And is there any mention in those on Metropolitan Council reform, since we've been talking about that a great deal?
Yes.
Ms. Ring.
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, there is not. That may be surprising to you. I know the Met Council is an item of a great deal of interest in the metro area. There's a diversity of opinion in the metro counties. There is some unity amongst some of those counties, but there's a diversity of opinion. And they've not brought that to AMC as an issue they want us to work on. I think that they feel that they need to provide you direct feedback from their individual county perspectives. They know that our job is to talk about statewide issues, but it just simply did not come up at the time that we had the discussion, which would have been in October.
Representative Nash.
Chair, thank you. Ms. Ring, I do appreciate that and still would very much like to have the legislative priorities broken out for District 10.
Yeah, certainly, Mr. Chair. I will ask that Matt follow up with you with that information.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to give you kudos on the infographic as well. Representative Pugh and I were commenting on how nice that was.
We really appreciate that. Thank you. A lot of times we put a lot of work into those things, and it's nice to hear that they're valuable.
Mr. Chair, could we have
Representative Nelson
given to all the members of the committee? that information that he's asking, though, the information he's asking for the metro, for the District 10 priority.
Absolutely, Representative Nelson. We'll make sure every member gets that information.
We'll forward it to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I wanted to ask about, I noticed three of the districts are concerned about assessor accreditation, and that's an area that I've managed to get myself involved in a little bit, but do you guys have answers? Are you going to focus on that? It does seem like the, you know, getting some uniformity across the board in terms of how these things are done is a fairly high priority, I would think.
Ms. Ring? Or Mr. Hilgart?
If you don't mind, Chair. Representative, thanks for that question. It will be very rare that our organization will say don't professionalize us or don't have increased education for us. But on this issue, we'd like to bring to the forefront that it's a workforce shortage issue as well. A lot of those counties that you see that as one of their priorities are dealing with workforce shortages in those areas already, and they're worried that this is going to be exacerbated because of it, the new assessor accreditation requirements that were put into place last year, I believe. So we are discussing with members of the Senate who originally had brought these assessor accreditation requirements into legislature. But we are open to suggestions. We have a lot of member counties. I would say conservatively 60 to 70% of our counties are concerned about those statutes, the new mm-hmm. requirements, and so we are open to dialogue.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I can see where, you know, in sparsely populated counties and so on, you can't necessarily hope for complete uniformity and so on, or professionalism, but you know, I would think that from an organization standpoint that you would want to push for that professionalism.
Sure. Mr. Hilgart.
Add a comment? I have one Ms. comment Ring? To add, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. You will see that issue did not make it onto our final list of priorities because there are different opinions about that statewide across counties. And because it's an issue that, as Mr. Hilgart said, we agree with the idea that there should be a level of consistency that citizens can expect, absolutely. I think the question we bring to you and that we want to engage in a conversation about is the accreditation requirement the way to get there? It may be, and we will not come to the legislature with an AMC bill saying that we should reverse that, but we're looking for ways to see how we can achieve the consistency in a way that is manageable for small counties who have limited resources in terms of their population. Mm-hmm. So we're open to ideas that you might have on that matter as well. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Nelson, did you have other questions?
No,
that was okay. Representative Joachim.
Yes, I thank you for the legislative priorities list too. I do notice that all but one district has transportation as one of their highlighted categories. Do you have a further breakdown on your legislative priorities than the summary on the sheet that you could give us on transportation? So I can imagine that it varies from region to region what the number one or top five priorities are.
Ms. Ring.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, I want to make sure I understand your question. So we have more information on transportation. You're looking for more information on the district breakdowns. Can you tell me a little
bit? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair. Just more information on specific issues in each area, if you're seeing more trends on one area prefers transit or all areas have an issue about transit, because that's going to be a big talking point up here at the legislature. And then one other question too, all but two districts mentioned mental health, and I noticed that you didn't have anything on mental health on your legislative priorities, so it'd be really interesting to see what issues around mental health that the counties are worried
Ring?
About.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so two responses. Absolutely, we can give you more information about how different districts feel about transportation. We do have a very unified position in AMC that involves all modes of transportation. I know that will be a hot topic for you as you wrestle with that issue, but would absolutely have our staffer, Abby Bryduck, follow up with more information for you on that. I have to at least add one caveat, that there is one district that didn't mention transportation. We do these district meetings, obviously, in a row, and there is sometimes some gamesmanship in districts trying to make sure all of their issues get on the list, and when they see that there's a very strong trend, sometimes they say, well, maybe that one doesn't have to be on our list because it'll for sure be covered. So I would just indicate to you that transportation is a priority in all 10 districts of the state. Regarding mental health, Mr. Chair and Representative, what I will tell you is two things. There is a really large mental health reform bill moving through that came out of the Department of Human Services, and we've been engaged in those conversations. So there will be conversation about how counties feel about the administration's proposal. The number one thing that we are concerned about is mental health beds and places for folks to go when they're in crisis. That is a very expensive proposition and difficult public policy issue to solve. And the reason it didn't make our list this year is we felt we should try to work within the reforms we knew would be brought forward to find the county-specific initiatives, recognizing that when we come and try to talk to you about the bed issue, it's going to be a really big lift. And given the release of the governor's budget, I think we'll have a lot of things to say about how we are managing the mentally ill population in our county jails and in the secure facilities that we help fund, as well as finding ways to do it in the community. And I'm happy to talk in depth with anybody who'd like to learn more.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you very much.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am understanding that the governor's budget has a great deal in transportation for the counties. Some indication that maybe it's 4 to 5 times more money for transportation roads than in the past, and that this might balance out other areas of the budget. Is this what you're experiencing, what you see in the budget?
Ms. Ring?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, what we know is that for probably 2 decades, when we came to talk to you, we talked about the fact that Health and Human Services was the largest budget driver for counties and the biggest driver on our property taxes. It's changed, and transportation has crept up. In some counties, it may have overtaken it. And so for us, the lack of funding for transportation is a property tax issue. We are very concerned about the amount of resources we have to put forward into transportation. And so we will be advocating for a significant investment in that area statewide in the modes of transportation that are selected by counties as most important to them.
Representative Lane, any follow-up?
Are you happy with the governor's budget on that area?
Chair and Representative Lane, I have not done the in-depth analysis, but based on what I have read, yes.
Any other member questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you both very much for your time. Thank you for your presentation. We look forward to some of that additional information coming back to the committee, and we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, Minnesota Association of Townships. As they're making their way forward, do I have someone that would like to make a motion on the minutes from our last meeting? Representative Pugh moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sewell. I'm General Counsel and Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota Association of Townships.
My name is Jim Fisher. I'm a board member for one of my townships up in the northern part of the state. I'm on the state board and also on the national board of townships. So.
Mr. Chair, we too are very thankful for this opportunity to inform the committee more about our association and about townships as a form of government. I know not everybody has encountered a township or has the understanding of the difference between a township and some of the other forms of government. So hopefully we'll be able to address a number of those issues this morning. The Minnesota Association of Townships is a nonprofit entity. It's voluntary membership. We have 1,781 of the 1,783 towns as members. Please do not ask me which two are not members. I most people pull that info out, but they have a combined population of 7. And so they just haven't quite decided to spend the money on our membership. We do contact them every year and make them aware of everything, but they have not pooled their resources to join us. Our association is governed by a board of directors that makes up 13 districts. We have divided the state in many ways. I believe Mr. Fisher has the largest district by area, given that he has St. Louis, Cook, and Lake counties. Quite a distance between individual entities to talk to them, but he does a great job. At the day-to-day level, we have an executive director, and I'll introduce him in his absence a little later today, but we have 13 full-time employees who are fully staffed and 2 part-time employees and 1 contract lobbyist who is hoping very much to get back here. He was in, got summoned by another chair, and is hoping to be back before the end of our presentation. I will note that 2 of our positions, we have 2 new administrative assistant positions that are now open. So if anybody knows of great candidates who have interest in local governments, you can talk to me or check out our website for that announcement. The positions are open to filled, and so again, we always are looking for anybody who, you know, has had some local government experience and may have some interest in working with us. Our primary purpose is to be the spokesperson for town government. That means that we obviously are here representing the interests of our townships before the legislature and the state agencies. But beyond just the normal lobbying efforts that you will see us on a regular basis, we do a lot more. Actually, we consider ourselves a training entity above and beyond all else. We do train town officers. We also invite city officials to join us on things that are of joint interest, like the open meeting law and election trainings. Our trainings are done primarily through short courses, as we call them. They're spring and summer short courses. The spring, we do 15 workshops. They go out for 3 weeks, crisscrossing the state, and then do 1 in the near metro area. And that draws between 3,500 and 4,000 town officers each year. The summer short courses, we do 8 workshops, and we'll have several thousand more attending those. We then in the fall do district meetings where we go out to each of the 13 districts, update them on the state of the association, legislative concerns, and issues of interest. But it's also where the members elect their directors. Our board of directors, the 13 directors, are elected by their local township officers. And so it's a chance for them to have the direct input on how the business is being run. We do an annual conference every year, the week before Thanksgiving. It's been that way since pretty much the beginning of time. There's a number of, we know it's a popular time for a number of events, but certainly anybody who's interested in popping in and seeing our conference, you're welcome to do so. Some of you will be invited to be speakers or to present information. And like I said, it's always the Thursday, Friday, Saturday prior to Thanksgiving. This coming fall, we will be up in Arrowwood. So just keep that on your calendar if you're interested. We also put out a number of informational publications on our website, mntownships.org. We put out a newspaper that we publish 10 issues a year, and we're trying to do much more website information. Our members are slowly coming along to technology, and I'll talk a little bit later about how we can get more of that happening, but we are trying to have a much more interactive website. And there's no code. It's open to anybody. You're free to go to our information library. In there, you'll find a couple hundred documents talking about open meeting law, talking about how to run a meeting, requirements for the town annual meeting, transportation issues, what is a road, how to maintain roads. If you really, really want to have some fun reading, you want to read the treatise on what is a cartway. There's a short version of about 15 pages, and then there's about a 60-page explanation by one of our township attorneys from Duluth, which analyzes virtually every case that has ever occurred on a cartway. For those not familiar with the cartway, it is a public access that is privately paid for and maintained that the legislature created, for better or worse, it's good employment security for me, but that when a parcel is landlocked, when somebody has a parcel of land that is completely landlocked, there is a public policy in being able to have access for emergency vehicles and other things. So that petitioner, if they can't gain access, negotiate directly with the neighbors, can come to the township, And then we are required to hold a hearing, determine that they are landlocked, that they have 5 acres or more of land, and where that cartway should be located, provide for the damages that be awarded, and away they go. But all expenses are paid by the petitioning party. So we're kind of just the middle person to negotiate on their behalf with the neighbors and get things done. We have an inquiry service where any of the township officers are welcome to call us. Any official township representative can call us. We do not take citizen calls. It is a conflict of interest for us to take a citizen call. There are some times where we will, on a special request, give a little bit of high-level overview to a citizen to try to resolve a specific issue. But in terms of a day-to-day, it would be a conflict of interest from a legal perspective to take citizen calls. We do provide constituent services, which any of you are welcome to take advantage of, where if you've got a specific concern, one of your constituents calls you about a concern in township, by all means, you're welcome to call me. We'll work with you, try to get you the answers you need to respond to that constituent. Another service that we can provide through constituent services, we do have a database and contact information for all 1,784 townships and the approximately 9,000 town officers that govern those townships. And we can generate lists for your independent district. It takes time to do that. I would appreciate that you not just call to have one. The constituent service office here in the house is given a electronic version of that catalog or database every time it's updated. So you can get it through your own house service, but if you have a specific need for contact information in your district, let us know. If it's for a constituent outreach service, the ethics board, if you will, campaign finances, so that we can provide that for free. If you want to do it for your campaign materials, you have to buy it like everybody else and decide how it fits within your campaign finance requirements. But that is a service we do offer. We have an insurance trust and bond program. We insure not quite all the townships yet, but pretty close. I think we're over 90-some percent now that have all coverages through us. It started off as strictly a bond program 30-some years ago where the clerks and treasurers of townships are required by statute to have a bond. They're the ones dealing with the finances. They're required to be bonded. It was very difficult to find a program that would do that and that was affordable. And so our association created a bond program that for a one-time $250 membership, we created the bond pool, and to date, 30-some years later, we've not had to charge a second premium. That bond program is self-sustaining, and we've had very, very few. I believe in my 15 years with the association, we've only had 4 claims against that bond. We do have a federal membership in NATAT, the National Association of Town and Townships, that Mr. Fisher is our delegate to. He was the immediate past president, that he serves his 2-year term as the immediate past or president, and now is the immediate past president of the NATAT. We also work collaboratively, as you can see from our PowerPoint. Thank you to AMC for downloading my PowerPoint so we didn't have to try to switch out technology in the middle. But we do work closely with LMC, AMC, and the School Board Association. We held a boot camp that some of you attended last week, explaining local government issues. We will be doing our Big Four Legislative Conference on March 5th, and we hope to see you there, if not on the 5th, maybe the evening of the 4th during the legislative reception. That will be down at the Crown Plaza. Townships is the first form of government. We started off in the state with congressional townships. They platted out 6 by 6 square mile, 36 square mile total, then entities known as the congressional townships. Then as citizens organized themselves, they would create the organized town. You'll hear the term town and township used interchangeably, and that's fine. For statutory purposes, the technical legal term is town. They are a town, it's a legal entity, but there are other states that make a real distinction between town and townships. We do not, but the legal term is town, but you'll hear everybody refer to the township. It's immaterial for all purposes. The one that is becoming an issue is the discussion of unorganized territory versus unorganized township. There is no such thing as an unorganized township. You will hear some counties referring to that. I believe there are 3 statutes that still make that reference. We're trying to get those corrected. It is unorganized territory. The reason that's such a distinctive point is there is no governing body for an unorganized territory. They are by default part of the county. And the county does have a number of statutes that give them authority to do special things in that unorganized area, but there is no separate governing body, and therefore there is no town entity. A typical town is governed by three supervisors. There's what's known as option A, where they can have five supervisors. Then there's also a clerk and treasurer. They can combine the clerk and treasurer positions, and they can go to an appointed clerk treasurer. We are seeing a slight increase in the number of towns interested in going appointed, because it allows the complexities of doing the paperwork and bookkeeping. Sometimes it's nice to be able to hire somebody with that accounting background, and even share it among townships. It's still not the norm. By far, 97% still do elected, but we are seeing a slight uptick in going appointed. Two-thirds of our townships still do the traditional March elections. The others have switched over to November. In March elections, they are elected to three-year terms, and the clerk and treasurer are elected to two-year terms. In November elections, about a third of our towns moved to that. Everybody is a four-year term by default, but a couple of years ago we came to this committee and received approval and then off the floor and signed by the governor the ability to go to a six-year term. Now, why would we go a six-year term? It allows, when you have a three-member body, to keep staggering, and you don't end up with a majority of the board being up for any one election. Township Day remains the second Tuesday of March. Whether or not they do November elections, still the Township Day, and they're required to do their annual meeting. At the annual meeting, what you'll see is annual reports given by the town board, or mainly the clerk and treasurers, providing an overview of the finances, the road repair, road work that had been done. It's the meeting where the residents grant authority for us to act. A number of the provisions for townships, we have to get voter approval at that annual meeting before we can take a certain action. And most importantly for the members, it is where they approve their tax levy. We have very little authority as a town board to modify the levy. When you take out debt and go through the legal debt process, then we have to increase the levy pursuant to the debt statutes. But other than that, if we want to modify the levy up or down, we need to call a special town meeting, which requires 10 days published notice. The residents control the tax levy and what they're willing to do. Now, I'm going to just put a little highlight here that will play into why some of our legislative issues are what they are. In the year 2000, we were 50% property tax dependent, 50% other revenues by the state auditor's report in the year 2000. We are currently, as of the last report, just a tad under 75% tax property tax dependent. And when you look at an aging population in rural Minnesota, 75% property tax dependency is just not a sustainable model. And so we hope to be working with all of you on ways to lower down that obligation. Some of the common town powers that you'll see are road and bridge maintenance. On a statewide average, that is 52% of township expenditures. We have 56,000 miles of official road, several thousand miles of seasonal roads, and minimum maintenance roads that don't qualify for state aid. We do provide fire and emergency services. We provide weed inspection. I know that may seem like a funny thing to highlight, but in rural Minnesota, that is critical. We actually have opposed, that is one mandate relief that our folks have opposed for removing the mandate, because it is a financial impact if the noxious weeds take control. We get them out of our right-of-way. We have inspection authority and private property to certify and provide notice and then work with the counties on abating the noxious weed problem. And it is a very important concern to the farm ag industry. And so it's one that our members take very seriously. We do have a number of townships that do planning and zoning. They provide the general government services, drafting the ordinances, overseeing their local elections, and providing their role in the state elections. And a number of other things. We do have urban towns that operate under Statute 368.01 that have authority to do a little bit more on their own outside of the annual meeting. But even in those urban towns, you'll find that they still rely on the urban meeting to give them the annual meeting. The urban towns rely on their annual meeting to still give them direction. Even though they may have independent authority, they want to hear what their people are saying. Very quickly, the legislative team, Gary Peterson is our executive director. He is unable to be here today. Of course, myself as general counsel and director of governmental affairs. Mr. Vanasek has made it back. We have a contract with Rob to provide additional work. So it's a little hard for me to be in every room at the same time, and so it's nice to have assistance. And then Jim, our district director, comes down to help, again, answer general questions. and what does the township introduce you to the township form of government and help us around here and those types of things. Excellent resource. Legislative issues that we will be working on, I will not go into the details unless you have questions, but just give you a quick highlight. Obviously, we want to protect the town form of government. There have been times where there's conversations about should we be abolishing townships? Are they really still serving a purpose? And we're going to tell you absolutely. You know, over almost a million residents of the state are governed by townships. It is the form of government closest to the people with that annual meeting. One of the key issues to protecting town form of government is, of course, annexation. The veterans on this committee know what a controversial battle that is. And we, of course, want to have a little more equity with the cities. The cities, of course, enjoy things the way they have it. We're very thankful the last biennium to have this committee support in holding us honest, getting us to the table to negotiate. If I may, Mr. Geldman helped foster communications when he was staffing this committee, and it was just very helpful to have that kind of support. What we're looking for this year to have the conversations on and hopefully get some action on is third-party interference on orderly agreements. When a city and a township reach an accord on how to handle annexation, which is the desire of everybody, we don't want to have third parties being able to come in and destroy that agreement. We currently have one situation where between the city and township, approximately $300,000 of tax money have been spent fighting the orderly agreement reached with another community, and we just don't think that's a proper use of resources. Comprehensive transportation finance bill, absolutely one of our two top priorities. And I know it's not an easy area to do, but I will tell you that the gas tax is where we get our best revenue source. It is what's the major source of funding for the Highway User Trust Fund, of which there's a 5% constitutional set aside for road and bridges, and then through the statutes we get 5% of that money that is split out in many, many ways. It's a complex formula, but that is the source of revenue that is most directly coming to us and allowing us to work on those 56,000 miles of road, the 6,000 bridges, 400 and some of which are on the deficiency list. So we're very open to ideas, but we need a transportation bill that is sustainable, that is long-term, and that increases the revenues so we can stop falling behind on our infrastructure. I am very happy that on our environmental side, it looks like MPCA is going to be able to work with us on some flexibility on the MS4 permits, which are very, very expensive for rural areas where you have maybe one or two blocks that are urbanized, high density, but they now have to spend several thousand dollars to have a planner come out and develop a plan for the entire township rather than just a small area that's actually subject to the MS4. And it looks like we now have enough flexibility, so I look forward to bringing that bill to you in the very near future. Wetland replacement ratios are a concern for us because, again, when you start having wetland credits purchased, they're not being purchased inside the developed cities. They're being purchased in the rural areas, our members, and that then affects our tax capacity and thus more and more property tax on the remaining residents. And, of course, I just talked about the noxious weeds. Payment in lieu of tax, PILT, is our second primary issue for the session. In 2013, we were very grateful to both the House and Senate for major reform, but we're hoping to build on that success and look at, as property is acquired, and we have, you know, the legacy fund that's being used to acquire more and more land. We're not saying that's a bad project or taking a stance on the individual issue. We're saying you've got to look at the complete impact of those acquisitions and the cost, because we lose our tax base forever. We have to shift the property tax dependency onto the remaining residents. And so we'd like to try to move towards a pay-as-you-go approach so that PILT does not end up becoming another one of those major problems to the general fund. The town aid was restored in 2013, and we look forward to working with everybody on keeping that formula reaching out to the smallest of communities. That actually is geared towards helping those with the smallest populations and least amount of development, and thus the least ability to have tax, property tax diversity. Election law, we will not be bringing an election bill this year except for one little technical cleanup that I think will be carried in the Secretary of State's bill. HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, remains a concern for many of our folks, and they'd like to continue having conversations about how do you most efficiently provide access for disabled voters without spending fortunes because the reality is, in the 10 years that we've had to have a mandate at the township level, they have not been used a single time that we can document, except by a handful of officers doing it as a demo. The Board of Appeals and Equalization is a training obligation, a mandate that we actually are supporting, because we do want to have our folks educated, as you heard the counties talking about on their side of things with the assessors. Unfortunately, we were informed in November that the Department of Revenue will now only provide online training. They will no longer provide in-person training in conjunction with our workshops. That's a major problem for us, because without broadband access in the rural areas, it could take several hours to download the first slide, much less a 2.5-hour training program. And so we will be working with you and the department trying to figure out how to provide that training. The last one on this list is the enforceable penalties for animals at large. If any of you have good ideas, please let me know. This is an ongoing issue in rural areas. It's becoming more and more, whether it's the dogs or the horse or the cow. It doesn't matter. But we haven't found the right solution yet, but we welcome input and ideas. With that, we will be happy to stand for any questions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of follow-ups on some of the things that Mr. Sulem shared with us today. This is not a finance committee, Mr. Sulem, but I am concerned about the HAVA issue that you brought up. And one of the things that we're starting to hear from Secretary of State's office, as well as counties and cities, everybody bought voting machines all at the same time, and they're all going to wear out at the same time. Can you, just for the benefit, because we do deal with elections in here, but again, not a finance committee, talk a little bit if you have some information as to how that might be impacting our townships in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, that is absolutely a concern. The first round of HAVA equipment were largely funded with a federal grant as a one-time shot. There is no discussion of additional federal fundings coming at this time. These machines cost several thousand dollars. The insurance policies cost quite a bit of money. Before you use them, they have to be assembled, turned on, programmed, and then tested. And that runs several hundred dollars. We figure that with the information we have, and I want to be honest, I don't want to try to mislead anybody, all we can rely on right now is some data that's more word of mouth from our members, not an official study or breakdown. But what we're seeing is they're telling us that it, on average, is probably costing an extra $2,000 per election at the township level. We do have an exemption for townships below a certain threshold, under 500 registered voters. They don't have to use it for the March elections. We all have to use it for November elections. But at the township level, it's estimated to be around $2,000 just to use the equipment, the purchase of the equipment. The counties would be making the acquisition, and then there would be working at the local level of how do we pay for that equipment, sharing with the county costs. And it is a major, major expense.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other, two other quick topics. One, dealing with the comments that Mr. Sulem made relative to public lands that are located within townships and things, because we do hear a lot, particularly where the supervisor is from, there's a lot of publicly owned lands in townships and counties. Do you see any issues that you would be bringing forward that might deal with school trust lands and or other state of Minnesota publicly owned lands? And for new members, one of the things we hear is we've got point A and point B, but we want to connect those for circulation of traffic in the town or the city or the community, but it's public lands and we don't get the state of Minnesota willing to come along, or we've got a long, arduous process with school trust lands that we need to go through to negotiate access or easement.
Well, and
Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, that is an issue that I have talked to the School Board Association about, and I think we have some general consensus of how to approach it. I'm not going to remember the exact year that it changed. I want to say about 6 years ago. The school trust land provisions were modified in a manner that required that full market value be charged for any easement. Prior to that, when we needed to verify a public access across school trust lands, it was a $500 application fee to cover the state state permit for that, and it wasn't a big deal. The law was changed, and the unintended consequence of how it's being interpreted is we've had a couple of townships told if you want to put the road there, it's going to be $30,000, $25,000.
the market value of that parcel, buying the easement, not buying the land underneath it, the access easement. And so the school boards have told us that that was never their intent. It's certainly not what they were trying to do. And so we continue to try to work with them on how to find that solution. As far as the trust lands not being taxable, most of that would be covered under the existing PILT formula. We're more concerned with the new acquisitions about some of the additional wetlands, the hunting grounds, the WMAs. And again, we're not saying that they're necessarily bad or that a particular project is the wrong thing. We're just saying when you have the discussion about is this the use, proper use of the state funds, you need to look at the total cost and the total impact. Because we still have to provide the road maintenance to those properties. We still have to provide the fire and rescue to those properties. In times, we actually see increased costs because instead of the farmer going in with one tractor, now it's turned into hunting lands, and people are going with their automobiles that have a much higher volume than just a single farmer. And so we actually see a need to do more road maintenance. And so we just ask that that be part of the conversation and that we try to find a funding source. The one that we're looking at would be to say that at the time of acquisition, the property tax that's owed in that year would become the base, and you would multiply it by a factor of X that we're working with the Board of Investments on. 5 years ago when we started this process, it came out to about 27 and a half years. We rounded it to 30. That if you took the current year, multiplied it by 30-year payment, invested that using the State Board of Investments guidelines, the interest rates on the investment would basically make the property tax payments. And so that's what we're looking at to see, is that still a viable approach? Is there a way that we can bring that forward this session?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final item, and it's probably not a question, it's more of a comment. That is, in fact, we have dealt with the issue of annexation, and I do dare say that it's provided job security for a number of people on both sides of the issue over the years, and I tend to believe it's going to do the same again this session. And I was a big advocate on wanting to move the annexation issues forward, as then-Chair Nelson knows from our discussions last year. So it's my hope that we will be able to get the cities and the townships together at the table to find an equitable solution, so we can free up those resources to work on other public interests instead of just annexation.
Mr. Sewell. Okay.
Thank you very much. And like I said, we welcome any suggestions, ideas. You know, sometimes a fresh set of eyes comes up with a new solution. But again, the polite prompting and nudging from this committee does go a long way towards getting things done.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Solem, I'm noting the comment you make in here about as rural populations age and decline in number. And I'm just wondering, is there a number of a population below which it doesn't make sense to be a township, an organized township? And what are you doing in those situations, or what do you recommend for townships that are in decline in terms of, you know, their spending and their budget? I mean, certainly, I mean, my view is you have a declining, you work on reducing the budget, reducing the spending in accordance with reducing population. But that does not sound like what you're saying here.
Mr. Sewell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, what we advise is that, you know, they obviously have the conversations, and with the annual meeting, they're having it with the electors. I mean, the people of the community are the ones that have the direct say on what services they're desiring, how they wish to pay for it, what they're willing to pay. And so we're encouraging those dialogues. The problem with, you know, say is there a point where the township isn't viable anymore, that doesn't solve the problem, because if the township were to dissolve, it would just now become the county's problem, become the county's issue, and those local residents, that cluster, would lose their direct voice. Yes, they'd have a county commissioner, but as you all know, the larger and larger of an area that you have to represent, and you know, all of you have that issue with your districts, it's harder to have direct contact and direct input. What we've actually seen in the last couple of years were some of the small cities dissolving back into the township, and so that you keep the density close, but they're running it at the town form of government, which was saving expenses.
Representative Runbeck.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you both for coming up and giving us a tour through the townships, and we look forward to working with you, and you have an open door with the committee here.
Thank
you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Next and last up on the agenda is the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. We've had a couple overviews on pensions, but we wanted to make sure that we also heard from the St. Paul teachers as well. So welcome both of you to the committee. State your name for the record, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Chairman Sanders, and thank you to the committee for having us. My name is Jill Schertz. I'm the executive director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I'm very lucky today to have my colleague and deputy director, Christine McDonald, with me as well. You know, I started today honestly believing we'd have the most interesting topic on the agenda, no offense to the others, until I found out that the first group brought an awesome infographic, which we don't have. And the second group got to talk to you about noxious weeds and animals on the loose. So with that, we'll turn to the fascinating topic of pensions. Thank you for having us again today. I feel like we're very lucky. I'm particularly lucky to be in this seat. I think that pensions and retirement security are one of a handful of issues for our generation. And as one of the last years of the baby boomers, it's personally a very important issue to me as well. I've only been in this seat for 6 months. I was fortunate to take over from an outstanding prior director, one of which you've probably worked with a great deal. That's Paul Doan. He retired after 3.5 years. And I believe he got to spend a lot of time with a number of you, as pensions were a very big topic on the agenda last year. And as a result of that work, the combination of Paul's efforts, our board, and the legislature, we're here to give you an update on the tremendous progress and I think the very good status you find St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund in today. And just as a reminder, a great deal of time was spent not only on the stability of the funds, all of them last year, but specifically the question of consolidation. And there was a question about whether Duluth and St. Paul, as the two independent funds, should be rolled into one of the state funds. Our board's position was we wanted to remain independent. We appreciated that you respected that. And I think that after a pretty serious financial review, the conclusion last year was to allow St. Paul to remain independent. So what we've tried to report here today is an update on where we stand, and again, our position that that was a valid decision, a good decision, and remains the right decision. Just as a refresher, again, we are independent from the three state funds. We represent solely the licensed teachers of St. Paul. We have about approximately 11,000 members. Of that, about 3,900 are active and about 3,100 retired, the remainder being an assortment of deferred members, disabled, or beneficiaries. When we look at our organization, we are subject to significant oversight. We report directly to a 10-member board of trustees. That's a combination of 9 active and retired elected trustees, as well as 1 ex officio member from the school board. As well, we're subject to significant oversight from the legislature and specifically the LCPR. We're also audited annually by the State Board of Auditors, and then every year, all of our crucial sort of metrics are calculated by an independent, nationally recognized firm, Gabriel Roeder & Smith. They come up with our funded status and other key metrics. As well, we wanted to present for you sort of a top view of the key metrics of pension funds to let you know both where we stand and the progress that's been made. First and foremost, we can tell you today that we are on track to reach our funded status by the required date. Second, our overall funded ratio has improved dramatically and is on the right track where it needs to be. We have had excellent investment performance on both a short-term basis and, even more importantly, a long-term basis. And again, we're one of the organizations that manages our assets separately from the state board, so we're a separate pool. We are very pleased to report that we have had a very similar good track record in that regard. And as you all know, you'll hear from your financial advisors, that's no guarantee to future success, but it is some indication of whether or not you know how to play the game. So I'm very pleased to tell you, last year we returned over 18.5% on a net basis. And on a 1, 3, 5, 10, and 20-year basis, we far exceeded the metrics and are at top of the peer nationwide. As well, our fund assets are now well over $1 billion, and they've returned to pre-crisis levels. And we believe that's a very key metric of an organization's health in the pension business. And as well, another key metric is demographics. If you'll remember from the debate last year, One of the key criteria for whether Duluth should remain independent or not was their demographic base. They were a very well-run organization, but they had a declining demographic base in that their active teachers, their current school population, simply could no longer support the retired base. St. Paul is very fortunate in the fact that it is a thriving city. We actually see a very stable to growing population. And in our schools in particular, when we meet with our districts, they again project not just stable, but a growth in the active number of teachers. So again, that's another key metric. When we think about the health of a public pension plan, we look at three key aspects, the trinity, if you were. Do we have stable contribution rates to support the plan? Do we have stable demographics? And do we have appropriate benefit levels? And as we look at the plan today, we think all of those three factors are in line for a successful, well-run plan. With that, I'll stop and see if there are any questions we could address.
I see Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I have has to do with, you mentioned the full funding date. What is your full funding date for the St. Paul Teachers Pension?
Ms. Schertz?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, like the other funds, we're on a fixed amortization schedule. So we look at our liabilities over a fixed cycle, a 28-year cycle. So I believe that our date is 2042. And then there's an actuarial calculation. Again, given your contribution rates, your demographics, and your benefits, can you reach that full funding status? Or in other words, can you pay your mortgage essentially by that date? Our actuaries, and again, we put a quote up on top. Actuaries don't like to get excited. They don't like to have a lot of emotion. This is as close as we're going to get to that. In their assessment, we are on track for that, and they say improvement in all of our key metrics.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I do remind you when I first time I was on the Pension Commission, it was explained to me that an actuarial is an accountant without a personality. anyway, thank you for the
noted
answer.
Any other member questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, for the committee's benefit, since I do serve along with Representative Nelson for the last few years on the Pension Commission, you hear a lot of numbers that are they're being bandied around, not just with St. Paul, but with Minnesota pensions and pensions in general. We're pretty fortunate in the state of Minnesota because our pensions are much better funded than other pensions across the country. What does that mean? It means if we're the state of Illinois, you don't want to be a pensionee in the state of Illinois. You'd much rather be a pensionee in the state of Minnesota. There's more predictability in our returns. There's more stability in our returns. And the Pension Commission, along with the individual boards of trustees of our state pensions and St. Paul teachers, do work very closely to provide oversight to be able to make sure that those benefits that we've made promised to people over the years are going to be delivered. One of the things that always causes us to step back and present some heartburn is there are always snapshots in time. Mm-hmm. You look at the numbers that are reported by the pensions by law, it's June 30th of that particular calendar year, which equates to a fiscal year, which there could be a lot of things that happen in the other 364 days out of the year that do not reflect in those numbers, either up, down, or staying the same. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's, I think, important for folks to keep in mind is that we're all living longer, healthier, and happier, which is all three good things to have happen. That means benefits will be paid out at a longer period of time. That is one of the things that's driving that full funding formula, because we have to figure out, and you heard the director point to the idea of a mortgage. So if you borrow $100,000 from the lender, the anticipated rate, time of return is 30 years. Well, that's how long you have to make those payments. And so we start out with a pensionee actuarially thinking 22 years, it might then move out to 24 and a half years, and it might move out to 27 and a half years. Well, that all affects that full funding rate. So the dollars are there. The longevity are the things that we have to balance, and to the benefit and to the credit of the different pensionees as well as the managers, we have been very fortunate in this state to be able to work across the table with the pensionees, reducing COLAs, modifying retirement ages, and getting full benefits and the like at the request of the Pension Commission and others, as well as the willingness of the pensionees or potential pensionees to step forward. So there are some things that are happening. Be thankful that you're a legislator in the state of Minnesota, not the state of Illinois or some of our friends to the east, New Jersey, and I won't mention some of the other ones because they're not here to defend themselves. But it's pretty good to be able to be a Minnesota pensionee and to be a legislator overseeing those types of things. And so I just wanted to share that as some background for the committee.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I know Ms. Schertz spent some time in Illinois, so I don't know if Representative O'Driscoll is aware of that or not, or how much pushback we'll get on that example. But Ms. Schertz, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, that was no reflection on your residency or time spent in Illinois. I think they're two independent events.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually born and raised in the metropolis of Peoria, Illinois, but then spent most of my adult life in New York. Now, I was told when I took the St. Paul job that they would forgive me for living in Minneapolis. They would forgive me possibly for coming from New York, but that I should probably just remind people I'm from Illinois, so I'm a Midwesterner and I'm okay. So I would make one comment. I truly appreciate your comments, Representative Driscoll. You know, it's interesting. I tease our retirees and say, you know, the women out there are killing us. It's the women that are living longer. So, you know, when we talk about our liabilities, we need to address the women in our crowd. We're just living too long. But the second thing is, When I look at this role, I think there's a tendency to think that the executive directors in our role, that we're just benefit administrators. And that's simply not the case, especially in our case where we manage our pool of assets. We actually are here to be stewards of a pool of assets for the long term. We have a century-long job and a commitment, so we have to balance those. It is not just about paying benefits.
Excellent. Thank you. And Representative O'Driscoll will be the chair of the Pension Commission, so you'll see that you have a knowledgeable chair to work with.
Mr. Chair, if I might offer one other comment. From what I'm hearing from the executive director, the men are doing their job to help stabilize pensions.
We're
Thank
here
you
to
for
serve
that.
Others. Yes. Any other member questions or comments? Ms. McDonald, anything that you'd like to say to the committee, or has Ms. Schertz handled it?
Thank you, Chair Sanders, and committee members. I am very blessed to work with our new executive director, Jill Schertz. I have been with the fund almost 13 years. I served about 10 years with the state auditor's office prior to that. So Jill does have to, at times, shake me loose a little bit, in terms of letting things be occur as they need to occur. But we do have good oversight in terms of audit, our actuarial reviews, and making sure that we are paying the benefits that we're required to pay by statute. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. I don't see any other member questions. Thank you both for your time today. We look forward to working with you. Members, that concludes the agenda. I will say, as we are building out the agenda for or up through deadlines, if you have bills that you would like heard in this committee and that you want moved through the legislative process, we're getting to that point in time where they need to get introduced pretty quickly here. So make sure if you have bills that you're working on or thinking about that you please make sure that those get introduced and work with Committee Administrator Amanda Tinsley. Make sure that we get some hearing requests and let us know what your wishes are. Representative Joachim, a question.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if you could give us an idea for our schedule for next week. We've not been having Tuesday meetings, and I just want to figure out if I can make appointments then.
Sure. We will let you know as soon as we know. One of the things that we will work with is, I'm not sure if Representative Rumbeck, she stepped out. There will be a subcommittee meeting next week during one of the committee hearings on the Met Council. So we will not have committee one day next week. I'm not sure which time that will be for the whole committee. But I'm not exactly sure what the entire schedule will be. We'll get that out probably later today or tomorrow, early in the morning for the schedule for next week. We will be hearing bills next week as well. So as soon as we have the schedule laid out for next week, we will send it to the full committee. Any other member questions? Not, this meeting's adjourned. Everyone have a good weekend.